This week, yes, there will be a show. The show must go on. Sometimes life gets in the way. Michael Santarcangelo could not join us today. He's okay, by the way, in case you're wondering. He's doing totally fine. Matt Alderman and I are going to cover the show today. We are going to lead off the first segment talking about a few stories that Michael had provided to us for the show, including how leaders should stop avoiding the hard decisions making smart people make, being in motion versus taking action. 10 things successful entrepreneurs never tolerate, the negotiation edge, and marketing's hidden treasure. Better CPE can unlock millions to fuel growth. And then we'll do the tracking security innovation segment. And I am super excited about this. Matt and I get to cover the Tenable IPO, which happened last Thursday. And news from Sophos, Fortinet. We'll cover some recent things happening with CA and the potential acquisition. Proofpoint and Imperva, which is very interesting, have some fiscal financial results to cover, which Matt and I promise you have an interesting take on that as well. And Imperva makes an acquisition. All that and more on this edition of Business Security Weekly.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals, by security professionals.
Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly.
Brought to you by today's determined attackers easily bypass even the most advanced network defenses. Trying to ramp up staff to detect their backdoors can cost thousands of dollars and take months, even years. With Active Countermeasures AI Hunter, we enable junior analysts to detect even the most advanced backdoors in a matter of hours. Sign up for a demo and purchase our product today by visiting activecountermeasures.com/BSW. Active Countermeasures, make every analyst a hunter.
Are you getting pressure to improve your data security? Would you like a faster, easier, better way to patch? Then you need to check out AutoMox. AutoMox is a cloud-native platform that patches and manages every endpoint, even remote servers and devices, including Windows, Mac, Linux, and third-party software, from a single dashboard. Improve your cyber hygiene, reduce your attack surface, and save 90% of the effort you spend patching. AutoMox, your patching system of record. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending your assets? Have you penetration tested your public assets? Start 2018 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting at blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night.
Welcome everyone to Business Security Weekly. This is episode 94. Very happy to be here. Sad that Michael Santarcangelo can't be here this week, but excited to cover the show, including some content that Michael provided, and always excited to welcome one of our illustrious Security Weekly hosts, Mr. Matt Alderman. Matt, welcome.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Back from Singapore. I'm back on time zone. That's good.
That's awesome. You recover quickly. You did a lot of international, still do a lot of international travel, Matt, so... That's good. That's
yeah, good. A bit. Not as much as I used to, but yeah, still a bit.
Well, it's good to have you back here stateside, Matt, and I'm excited that, well, you and I get to cover the Tenable IPO in the second segment of the show, which should be quite kind of interesting as we both used to work there and may or may not have a vested interest in Tenable doing well with their IPO, which is good. I'm excited for Tenable, and I can't wait to dig into it a little more and compare and contrast some other interesting, I think, results from other companies that, you know, maybe have already gone public and see how they're doing. I'm starting to get more into this whole, I think the Tenable IPO really made me pay attention to the market overall a little more. But Matt, you're the expert in that area as far as I'm concerned. So
I'll do my best.
Yes. I think our survey is done. Our good friend Dan from Straight Talk, I think, is who's helping us analyze the results from our survey. It could be done, or it could be that I've screwed things up so massively on our website that it's not working. I mean, either of those are very likely. If you're experiencing issues getting to anything today, on Monday, July 30th, especially just wait a little while. Things should settle out. And then after that, if you do notice something, some listeners have sent us email in already and noticed things are broken. We're in a major kind of migration off of some infrastructure onto some new infrastructure. So if you notice anything broken, you know, just let us know. If there's especially legacy things that you're like, I can't get to this anymore, definitely let us know, because I'm not sure how much of that legacy content I'm going to keep around. So keep an eye on things for us. It's greatly appreciated as we are in the middle of a server migration. So I think our survey has officially ended. And, you know, we'll have more surveys, maybe with a slightly different focus to come. Now, make sure you come check us out at the Pool Cabana at Black Hat and DEF CON. We've got the Cyber Hero Adventures comic book that we'll be distributing alongside Gary Berman, who's the author of that and made appearances on this show and Paul Security Weekly. So check that out. We'll have things for sale in the vendor area. We're taking briefings. We're doing sponsored interviews. In fact, if you or your company is interested in a sponsored interview, it's not too late to sign up for a sponsored interview at Black Hat. We'll be doing all new trivia series, all kinds of things. Look for us in the pool area at Mandalay Bay and Caesar's Palace in a very a short while. In about a week or so, we'll be out there. So, Matt, you'll be out there. You'll be helping us out. You'll be out there. Now, does Layered Insight have a booth?
No. For Layered Insight, it's not really our crowd, right? Yeah, we're okay, more working cool. with the dev guys and the application security folks, not really our sure. event. So I'm coming out to help you, and you know, I'll probably do a few Layered Insight meetings, but
right.
You know, I'm really there to help you with interviews.
I love it. We get Matt's full attention. It's going to be so much fun. I get to work the floor with Matt. It's going to be awesome. And Matt, we're doing briefings of separate companies, a whole yeah. list of separate companies, which that'll be interesting content, certainly for the show.
Yeah, I think we're over 100 requests right now. Mm-hmm. I've got a couple more in my inbox today that I got to take a look at. But yeah, we've gotten requests for well over 100 interviews. So yeah, we got to go through and get as many scheduled as we can.
That's right. And we're cherry picking them, which is nice. The ones that we're interested in, which I think is really cool. So, okay, let's dig into our stories for this week. Leaders should stop avoiding the hard decisions. And I tell you, being in a leadership role, it's all about decisions, and lots of decisions, and some harder than others, as you can attest to, Matt.
Yes, very much so. We've had to make a few hard decisions in the past as well. And sometimes they fall your way too. So you never know.
That's right. It's you know, every day there's some decision making happening, and I think that you know, John Strand and I have actually talked about, like, at what point do we hand off responsibility to some of our employees? Because previously we've covered articles here on Business Security Weekly that you should reduce the number of decisions that you have to make in any given day. There are some entrepreneurs, Matt, that really take this to a whole new level in that they lay out their outfits and structure their clothing for the week so that they don't have to make as many decisions. Like, they actually buy specific clothing, lay it out the night before, so it's like one less decision they have to make for the day. I mean, that's extreme. But then I also like to empower my employees. And John Strand has, like, the great words of, you know, John Strand wisdom on this. He's like, as long as you're trying to make the right decision and you put some thought behind it, I trust you to make decisions. Like, just don't screw it up. I added that last part. But, you know, you have to empower your people who you trust in your organization to make some of those decisions. And I think that also helps, in addition to maybe your wardrobe, you to focus on some of the more difficult decisions, perhaps the bigger decisions that could have far-reaching impact.
Yeah, and this one ties into another article on motion versus action. And it's really moving things forward to an outcome. And yes, that means sometimes you have to make these hard decisions, right? And so when we talk about that article a little bit, it ties in here, is in order to move a company forward or to get a desired outcome, you will have to make hard decisions along the way. You cannot avoid them because by avoiding them, you're not going to get those desired outcomes. You're just going to continue to kind of spin as a company. So
yeah, you'll just be in motion, in most likely a circular motion, right? For some time and not actually moving forward. I completely agree.
Yeah, exactly right.
And I mean, you know, at some point you got to come to that crossroads and for better or for worse, pick a direction. I mean, and hopefully there's some, you know, other factors you're taking in consideration and you're not just flipping a coin. Although those of us that have been in positions to make those decisions, sometimes I'm like, this could go either way. Like, let's just pick a direction and go with it. And you deal with the fallout from whatever direction that you've been in or chosen to go in, right?
Yeah, I mean, the concept of fail fast is an interesting one, right? Is that you're making a decision, but if it's the wrong decision, fail fast and then make the appropriate course adjustments. By not making the decision, you don't know if it's the right or wrong decision, and so you're not, you know, figuring out how to move things forward. And so even if you make a hard decision, you make the wrong one, fail fast, and then go ahead and make the appropriate adjustments. Yes.
Right. Completely agree. Yeah, we've been a lot of those kind of style decisions have been happening lately, especially here at Security Weekly, right? And more about adjusting our internal processes, what tools we use. And sometimes I'm like, let's just try it and see if it works. Like, you know, we can weigh the options until we're blue in the face. And that just leaves us in that motion phase, or we can pick something and try and go with it. And if it's the wrong decision, well, then, you know, we back up and try something that maybe will work better.
Yeah, facts help, but it doesn't mean you're always going to make the right decision at the end of the day.
Right. Now, I love these articles that, you know, I guess you could kind of call them clickbait, and it's tough to weed through. Michael does a great job of weeding through the clickbait into articles that actually say something that's meaningful. And so sometimes you might read some of these headlines and think, oh, well that's clickbait. But no, Michael is validating these. And this one's, you know, 10 successful things entrepreneurs never tolerate, you know. And we see these, I'm sure you see them too, Matt, right? Like 5 things every successful entrepreneur does, you know. And it's like they work out every day. It's like, I get that, all right? I understand to be a successful entrepreneur, you got to work out every morning at 5 a.m. I mean, if you read these articles, that's one of the primary conclusions, Matt. Have you seen these articles that say that?
Yeah. All those personal habits influence kind of your drive to be an entrepreneur and to be successful in that kind of space, yeah. It's like my wife and I getting up every morning going, okay, it's time for our walk, right? The 2.5 miles around the loop or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. It's something you just do every day.
Right. And I think, you know, routine is certainly a big part of that. But Matt, what is this article trying to dig into in terms of things that entrepreneurs don't like, which I think is an interesting spin on it? It's usually it's about the habits of entrepreneurs. These are things that entrepreneurs don't like.
Yeah, exactly. And if you go down the list, it's a little interesting. The first one is inaction. We were just talking about this whole make hard decisions, you know, action versus motion. And the first one on this list is inaction, which means you're not making those decisions, right? So that these all tie together. Some of the other ones are kind of, they're okay, like being average. I mean, that's kind of a hard one to kind of measure that and say, well, I'm average. Am I really average?
Well, Matt, and you just go back to the inaction one, right? I think this is about empowering your employees as well and allowing them to move forward. Be like, yes, that's the right direction. Like, go make the decisions that allow you to follow this path. And I think as, you know, a leader, you have to set the overall direction and then, you know, pass some of that responsibility off to people who you trust to carry out your vision, right? And that allows you to then do a lot more focusing and not have to make every decision along that journey. Like a silly example, we're ordering, and I mean, Matt, you've done this too, right? You're ordering all of your marketing materials for a conference. I've, you know, like I've passed that to the team. I'm like, I think we should have something like this. It, you know, here's the goal, should, you know, get our brand out here in this way or whatever. I'm like, go have it. And they're like, well, you know, does the logo look good here? I'm like, nope, I trust you to make all those, you know, decisions that are going to come after this to follow that path and make it happen. And now, thankfully, when we go to Black Hat and DEF CON, we've got awesome stuff to give away, awesome stuff to have for sale at our vendor booth as well. But that was one where
I had done that so much in the past, and you know, the team was definitely ready to take full on that responsibility. So,
right. But yeah, and you need to let the team do what they can do, right? You can't do everything. Even as a small company in Layered Insight, I mean, there's, you know, we're all running around like chickens with our heads cut off doing stuff to keep the company moving in the right direction. It's not one person. It can't be.
Yeah.
And but there's a couple really good ones in here that I think are important. Number three is habitual negativity, right? As an entrepreneur, it's all about optimism and being positive, and you know, you're trying to take an idea to market and grow a successful company. So negativity, number five, dishonesty on this list is a killer, right? I mean, if you cannot trust and have honesty across the team, it will kill any kind of startup out there from the beginning. And so those are a couple there. Then it leads into toxic relationships, which kind of is part of this whole dishonesty loop. Those are really, really good ones in this article. And then I went down to the bottom. And number 10 is acting out of anger. And this is probably the one I'm the worst at, by the way, because I'm so competitive that when something happens, you're like, God dang it, I'm going to do it anyways. So number 10 is probably the one that I have the hardest time with.
No, and for me, I don't know if it's so much anger as it is spitefulness sometimes with me, right? Because I'm just like, well, I want to do that just to like prove everyone wrong. I want to do that because I want to see I can do it. But it's like, you can't run your business based on anger or spitefulness. Like it doesn't work that way. Right. And you know, there's I think it's a Winston Churchill quote. That's like, if you stop to pay attention to every barking dog, you know, along the way, you'll never get where you're going on your journey. And I think a lot of these things are about that, about keeping the mission for your company, taking your vision in a positive direction and just kind of letting go of some of those other things that might slow you down, including, you know, people who are dishonest or, you know, acting out of anger or spitefulness, certainly. So,
yep.
Yeah, I
agree.
So this one, next one was about negotiating, which is kind of interesting, as my wife is part of a union here in the hospital, and those of you who are paying attention to the news here. And, you know, there's a lot of negotiating going on, and my assessment is it's not going very well. And I, you know, think about some of the things that I've learned about negotiations, and you run into some of those times where like it's way beyond my skill level. I'm like, wow, this is just going bad. Like, is it going bad on purpose? Of course, this comes from the Black Swan Group, which has never split the difference. Chris Voss, his company, which one of the best, I think, books on business or negotiation, or just a book everyone should read to get through life. And so his blog has been really great. And this one's, you know, about asking the how and the what questions, which are important to his, you know, kind of theory in negotiating. Have you read the book, Matt, or read this article?
I haven't read the book. I read part of this article. And the interesting part of this article is we say yes a lot, right? Is when we're in these discussions, and what he's saying is you're lying. And how do you find out whether a yes is a lie or not? And it's digging into asking the next question is, okay, how do you do that? Or what is that? So that they have to clarify the yes, because a yes by itself could mean a whole bunch of things. And what he gets into a little bit here is asking that next level question, because as a society, we're so used to yes being a positive thing. We're like, okay, off to the next question.
Right.
And here he's saying, nah, you're being lied to when they say yes. You better ask those next set of questions to understand, did they really mean yes, or are they just pulling your chain? And that's what I liked about this article.
Yeah, and in negotiations, you know, Chris will teach you about trying to understand, having empathy as being probably the most important thing you learn from Chris's book, and how to, like, empathy is something you can learn how to do better. And it's completely different from sympathy, right? But these questions that follow a yes response are to really dig into what is the other person's motivations? What do they really want? And by uncovering and exploring what that yes really means is uncovering the other person's intentions. And, you know, all of the examples that Chris gives in his book is negotiations completely improved in a positive way once Chris could understand what the other person really wanted. And what they're telling them, as Matt alluded to, is usually a lie. And Chris's techniques allow you to dig into what that other person wants, which is a really powerful form of negotiating or negotiating skill to have. And it's one of the things. And the other person, like, you know, in Chris's world, someone's being taken hostage, right? But in your daily life, you're likely, in an everyday basis, not negotiating with someone who's taken someone hostage or kidnapped someone, right? You're likely on the other side of some kind of business negotiation or business deal. And sometimes people just do that unintentionally. And I find that Chris's resources really help me uncover, like in our situation, for example, when we work with a partner or a sponsor here at Security Weekly, how do we dig into, like, really what do they want to get out of the program as an example, right? So I'll use Chris's kind of indications so that I want to truly understand, you know, what they want out of the program, what their goals and expected outcomes are, and we'll ask that explicitly. So, and that's important when you're on the other side of that, Matt, in your position, when you're talking with customers, it's the same thing. I mean, you're not necessarily in a, I mean, you are in a negotiation, but even before that stage of negotiating price, which is what we always think of as negotiation, the first part of that is trying to figure out if you can solve their problem, and getting what that problem is out of your customers, right? Is maybe, and it's not that they're intentionally hiding it, but these questions can help you pull that out of your customers. Have you thought about using that in this way?
Yeah, because they may not know. Mm. I mean, that's one of the big challenges in the security startup space right now is, do customers really know the problems they have and how best to solve them? So you've got to be able to answer a set of ask a set of questions to kind of probe in and really kind of get to the root of, you know, what is your problem? And does this solve it, or is it completely something else? And it's hard to do. This is why I do the interview process with most of my clients when I do anything on the advisory side. It's the same process I ran the Layered Insight guys mm-hmm. through when I joined, which is really starting to understand what they believe the problem is, why their approach is unique or different or better. Mm-hmm. What is that value you can provide back? It takes a while to extract that out. Luckily, I have a set of questions that help me do that. But yeah, every single customer you have to kind of do the same thing for.
Right. I think our questions are probably pretty similar, Matt, because we talked about going to Black Hat and doing the briefings, right? We're going to use similar style of questions in our briefings. And likely our question sets are pretty... we'll have to compare notes before we go to Black Hat, Matt. But we have a very similar... set of questions yeah. and different ones for different situations, whether it's a phone screening or, you know, depending on what the situation, if it's on the Black Hat floor, you know, you kind of trim those back and you got to pick and choose like what you might want to go after in terms of information. And it depends on who you're talking to, right? Like to kind of transitions into Black Hat, you know, when Matt and I and others from Security Weekly, when we go walk the floor, we know from previous experiences that likely there's going to be a higher percentage of salespeople on a show floor than any other persona in that company. So I like to structure my questions around, well, what does a salesperson typically experience? And what do I want to know about their experiences that can help me? So I ask some questions like, well, so when you close the deal, even before they've started using it, you know, what if they say, what was the deal closer for them? What was that like one thing that you did really well that the customer called out to you and said, you know, like we had our selection of half a dozen vendors, but we chose you because what's that number one thing? And usually the salespeople, they know that, right? Because they want to use that in their next sales deal if they're good, and most people do. So there's a whole bunch of questions like that. And we'll be releasing sets of our questions as well. But Matt, I assume you have similar style of questioning.
Yeah, and you're going to see sales guys, you're going to see marketing guys, right? Mm-hmm. So I also want to understand the real message behind the message on their booth, right? Mm. Because vendors use a lot of the same terminology, and it's extremely confusing to customers, by the way. Anybody watching this who thinks you call yourself an AI threat intelligence company that people understand what that is, they don't. Okay. Mm-hmm. And everybody uses these same terms over and over and over again. So what I want to do is I want to peel the onion back, and I really want to understand, what is it that you do? What is the real value behind that? I know what you call it, but what does it actually do?
Right.
That's a whole different set of questioning that I want to get from the folks when I interview them as well, because I'm trying to cut through the noise, because there is a lot of noise out there with people saying the exact same thing over and over and over again. And how do you differentiate one vendor from another if you don't understand some of those deeper questions and kind of basis for the message? It's going to be hard for you to shine with your customer base. And that's what I like to dig into.
Yeah. And usually if you ask like that vendor in particular, like, are you an AI threat intelligence company? They're like, yes. And there's your yes response that you got to dig into. And sometimes I'll take the opposite approach and I'll say, so you're like something similar to threat intelligence, and they'll say no, like right away. So you can kind of dig at what they are by trying to solicit that no response, which is something that Chris also talks about in Never Split the Difference. It's so much fun to put these in practice in the next week or so. I'm excited.
We'll have fun.
So, Matt, this last article was about some marketing. Better CPE can unlock millions to fuel growth. First, what do they mean by CPE, and how does that relate to growth?
Yeah, so they're talking here about consumer promotions and engagements, trying to get customers to buy their products versus the traditional way of doing it, which is advertising and trade dollar spend. And what they're analyzing here is these promotions and customer engagements actually have more effect at a lower price point than some of the advertising that they're doing or the trade shows. And look, I can tell you from a trade show side, you get trade show fatigue. You know, I was just over at RSA in Singapore. In my opinion, it's shrinking. It looks smaller. The booths are closer together. There are major security vendors not at that event. And it's a little concerning to me because that event, for example, had been self-sustaining and growing over the past few years as I've been attending. But this year, going over to Singapore, it looks smaller, right? So I think there is a level of trade show fatigue. You're not getting the return on investment. And they're saying, look at these customer promotions and other customer engagement activities, doing your own customer events and other things. It's a much bigger bang for the buck when it comes to generating leads, generating revenue, than just these broad advertising or trade show campaigns. So I thought it was very interesting because I'm seeing some of the same things.
Yeah, I've have a lot of thoughts and opinions on how you can get value out of a trade show, and also where I think there's a misconception about value. But I think is if you know all of the pieces, you can make the most out of the trade shows that you do, and use your other marketing activities to enhance your presence at a trade show. And I think that it also depends who your target profile is and how you structure your product. You know, I've read articles from companies that were like, well, we made sales right on the show floor. I'm like, well, first of all, if your product is positioned to be that easy of a deploy and that price point where they can actually sign the deal right there, like a company that's selling, you know, $50,000 plus product that requires a lot of integration to multiple teams to support it, probably not going to make that deal on the trade show floor. However, if you can sell a device that's $5,000 and $10,000 and can have some immediate impact and is easy to deploy, yeah, you can make you. That's awesome. If you can make sales right in the trade show floor, absolutely, you should do trade shows. But that's not everyone, right? And it all depends on how you're going to target your persona. And I think that's one of the most challenging things on the trade show floor is how do I get the right people from the right industry with the right problems and speak to the right person? How do I get that person to my booth that is my target profile in all the things, not just the industry or the size of the company, but they have to have the problem that you're solving, right? And then that person has to be a decision maker. How do I get those people to the trade show? And so we could do a whole segment, Matt, a series of segments on trying to get the most out of the trade show.
Yeah, and it's tough because the way most people measure trade show success is number of leads, cost per lead, and try to track that from a revenue side. And again, you may not see your buyer persona there. The mm-hmm. company might be there, but the buyer you're trying to sell to may not be there, which is why you asked the question about Black Hat and Layered Insight. It's not our buyer persona.
Right.
So why would we be there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you have to hand sell to everyone that comes to your booth, right? That's the other hard thing that I think a lot of vendors underestimate is they want to go make a presence and get their messaging across in the trade show floor. And what I think that sometimes they don't realize is that everyone that comes there is going to, like have Matt's question, they're going to see your message on the thing and they're going to ask you, well, what does that really mean? So you have to explain it to everyone that comes to the booth, right? Whereas there's lots of other things you can do to get your message out there, let the masses consume that so that maybe when they do come to your trade show, they're already at a certain place. And, you know, it's a touch point. Then we can talk about funnels if we wanted to and all that stuff. But I think to Matt's point, sometimes you don't know like how much impact did a particular activity like a trade show, how much did that contribute to some kind of sale? And sometimes that can be a really hard thing to figure out.
Yeah, definitely. It's a really hard metric to track. And that's why you see some people saying, do we really need to do that? It depends, you know, what you're trying to accomplish. If it's brand awareness and recognition because you're getting ready to go public and you just want to make sure you're top of mind. Look, Qualys did a lot of that before they went IPO. They had very successful IPO and it worked for them. Others haven't had to go to that extreme. You know, Tenable was, I think, a gold sponsor at Singapore, mm-hmm. you know, where I was on stage keynoting for them when I was there. So they've dropped their membership down and they were going IPO mm-hmm. at the same time of the event. It wasn't a big component for them. So it varies company by company, too.
Mm. Absolutely. Cool. Well, with that, we're going to take a short break, come back and talk about tracking innovation, lots of really cool announcements from a lot of companies that we'll go over. So stay tuned. Are your existing solutions able to take advantage of real threat intelligence? Common solutions like firewalls weren't designed to handle the massive and growing volume of threat indicators. This challenge often results in significant gaps in your protections, even when you think you have it covered. You need to protect yourself by filtering network traffic against unique threat indicators in a way that allows you to act. Palo Wall by Bandora Systems is the solution that filters over 10 million indicators right out of the box. Developed in partnership with the Department of Defense, Palo Wall is affordable for companies of all sizes. Get your free trial today at BanduraSystems.com. Rapid7 powers the practice of SecOps. Using shared data, analytics, and automated workflows, SecOps unites IT, DevOps, and security teams to make security an outcome of innovation. Rapid7 combines technology, expertise, and advocacy to drive vulnerability management, application security, incident detection, and log management for more than 7,000 organizations worldwide. Power up your SecOps practice with a free trial at rapid7.com/securityweekly. Skeleton keys, golden tickets, forged packs, DC sync, DC shadow. The Active Directory attack surface is expanding faster than admins can keep up with. Securing your environment begins with implementing least privilege administrative models, but does not end there. Many organizations send Active Directory syslog events to a SIM platform. However, logs are noisy, of limited scope, and are time-consuming to review and act upon. Active Directory is secure when it's clean, understood, configured properly, monitored closely, and controlled tightly. StealthBits Technologies provide solutions that monitor, secure, and detect the latest threats against Active Directory. Visit them today at stealthbits.com to learn more. Welcome back, everyone, to Business Security Weekly. I'm here with Matt Alderman, and we're going to talk about some of the security innovations and company announcements, starting off with, of course, Tenable's recent IPO, which happened last Thursday. Now, what's interesting, Matt, we're just talking about marketing. On CNBC, they say cyber risk management company Tenable. I think they meant to say cyber exposure company Tenable, which was in their marketing at the NASDAQ stock exchange when they opened up.
Yes, exactly. If you saw some of the articles leading up to the IPO, it said Tenable, the so-called cyber exposure company. And then in this article, they don't call them the cyber exposure company. They call them the cyber risk company, which is a little interesting. But look, at the end of the day, it was a good IPO.
Absolutely.
For anybody tracking security IPOs. And look, it's a little higher than I thought it would be, but it's in the range. And yeah, let now, me Matt, tell you kind of you wanna, my evaluation for that at some point. Yeah.
Well, a little background first. So when they talk about the company's market value, you call that something different, their market cap. And there was a debate, was it $2.5 billion or $3 billion? What does that mean?
Yeah, so there's a couple things. So in the S-1, it talks about the market size and the overall addressable market areas, right? Which they were saying was somewhere around $5 billion or something like that. And then when the stock comes out, based on its price and its number of outstanding shares, it has a market capitalization. What is the company worth with all the shares at the current price point, right?
Yep.
And so if you look at comps for Tenable, you have to look at Qualys and Rapid7. Mm-hmm. They are the other two in the core space, right?
It's like when you buy a house, you look at comps, right? What is everyone else selling exactly. for in the same neighborhood?
Yeah, exactly right. And so Qualys is running right around $3.5 billion market capitalization. Their mm-hmm. stock has been on a tear lately. I mean, it was over 95 at the IPO. I think it's pulled back a little bit as the market the past couple days, late mm-hmm. last week, pulled back a bit.
Yeah.
But it was up in the like 97, 98 at one time.
I was shocked. And I don't follow the market. I mean, I follow some of the security companies just because we're following the industry as a whole. And I remember Qualys pretty much always trading around that $30 a share. And then at some point, it was trading around 45. And it seemed to be a lot of people who had Qualys stock were really happy about that. And then when I checked on it around Tenable's IPO time, it was like at 96 or 97. I'm like, well, that's like almost double where it was before. Like, wow.
Yeah, it's been on a great performance. And it put the capitalization of Qualys at $3.5 billion. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's one point. The second point you have to look at is Rapid7. Now, Rapid7 stock's done very well over the last year as well. I think it's up 70% this year. But its market cap is about $1.5 billion, okay? So it's $2 billion less mm-hmm. than Qualys. And if you look at a number of factors, by the way, you look at revenue, you look at growth, you look at profitability, their market capitalization is less. Now, if you looked at the S-1 from Tenable, the logical expectation is Qualys comes in between Rapid7 and Qualys. Tenable has more revenue than Rapid7, mm-hmm. not quite as much as Qualys. It has a higher growth rate.
I'm sorry,
over 40% almost.
Tenable comes in between Rapid7 and Qualys in terms of market cap.
Qualys.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, market cap, right? Mm-hmm. Tenable's revenue's higher. Their growth rates are higher. They're not profitable yet. So I never expected them to be a $3 billion plus market cap. They mm-hmm. did when they first came out at, when the stock first came out at like 33 or whatever it came out at, it mm-hmm. put them in that $3 billion range. It pulled back. They're sitting at about 2.7 right now, mm-hmm. I think is the number. That's about right. My guess was they would be around $2.5 billion market cap. That's kind of a logical place for them. I saw articles this morning that they're a little undervalued, so you could see some more uptick in the stock. It'll be interesting to watch as a shareholder. I'm interested.
Well, now the advice that I got was to not watch, like for the first 90, 180 days. Yeah. Everyone's like, just don't watch. You're just going to drive yourself nuts. And I'm like, I can't not watch. Like this is exciting,
right? I mean, it's exciting, right? I mean, how many people? So I watched the Qualys IPO because I had Qualys stock as well. Mm-hmm. This is my second IPO. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a great day for anybody holding Tenable stock. I think it was a really good valuation. Definitely in line, actually a little more than my expectations were, to be honest. Can it maintain? So now it's up to the company to continue to deliver mm-hmm. on, you know, growth, sales growth, bookings growth, revenue growth, etc. They will have to have a plan to get to profitability. I think the reason Qualys, even though it's a slower growing company, mm-hmm. it has been profitable since day one.
Yeah.
It entered the market profitable. That company has been profitable from day mm-hmm. one, and that gives it a higher market cap than its competitors. And I think that continues until mm-hmm. Tenable shows some signs of profitability. If they can get profitable, I think they could see their market caps go above Qualys at some point, primarily because their growth rates are almost double, if not over double, what Qualys's are. So time will tell, but Yeah, it was a great Thursday for a lot of people.
Now, Matt, those of us that are listening that are executives in cybersecurity today, how does the market aspect that we just discussed in vulnerability management, like, how does that impact your solutions, where you buy, the decisions you make? Does it at all, or is this just a market conversation separate from, you know, a solutions conversation?
Yeah, they're a little bit different in that, you know, the market's looking at a company more from a financial perspective. Mm-hmm. They're looking at things like revenue, profitability, growth, et cetera. And each market's going to be analyzed a little bit differently, based on its technology, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, cloud-based companies and software-based companies are going to see a higher valuation, for example, than a hardware-based company. So it does play into the markets when it comes to valuation, but there are just core things that the market's always going to look at, regardless of, you know, your product or your solution, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why you got to look at your kind of your closest comps and say, what's realistic? In this case, it hit reality, which was good.
So congratulations to Tenable. I think it's awesome. You know, I'm just, it's awesome to be, have been part of that, you know, journey in my time working there. And, you know, they were a big sponsor of the show. So it's exciting for everyone. And also exciting that it was all positive, you know, for Tenable in the community. I think it's cool. It's awesome.
Yep, now, it was a great day.
Now, Matt, what I think is interesting is when we talk about CA Technologies, it is one of the largest acquisitions I think we've ever discussed here on the Security Network. They're talking about being acquired by Broadcom for something like $14 billion, I think was the number. And I put an article.
Oh, 19.
Was it 19? Okay.
Yeah, 19.2 or something like that. Yeah.
That went up. It was 18.8 something. Now, what's interesting is the article, and I want to get your take on this, Matt, is that the some bank, Amalgamated Bank, has $1.4 million in holdings in CA, and they've raised their position in the shares of CA. Is that because they could be acquired, which means their shares in the company will go up in value? Is that pretty much what's going on here?
Yeah, so if you look at the CA numbers, I looked at them briefly before the show, mm-hmm. they're sitting just under a $19 billion market cap. And so when Broadcom put in the offer for them, it was 18.9 or something mm-hmm. like that. So if the stock was under that price point, then by buying more shares at a lower price, you potentially make more money when that transaction goes down, because mm-hmm. Broadcom is going to buy at a higher price point. So when you see an acquisition like this, a public company, same thing happened when Dell bought EMC, by the way,
yeah,
way a few years mm-hmm. back. Okay, you looked at what Dell was going to pay price per share, and you looked at it and said, oh, well, it's at 20, it's going to sell for 23 or whatever. I can make $3 more per share,
yeah.
right? So everybody's going to make some short-term moves. Mm-hmm. Those moves typically happen within the first 24 to 48 hours of an announcement, and then things will kind of settle out. They'll wait for the transaction to happen. Mm-hmm. Everybody will cash out. So that's why the bank probably did it. They had some upside in the stock price that they could buy some more, make a little more money as part of the acquisition.
And so this acquisition sounds like it's going to take place then.
Yeah, I mean, there's a due diligence. So with every announcement like this, there's mm-hmm. a process. There's the due sure. diligence process, technology, business, there's structures and things that go through. They've probably done a good chunk of that already. There's probably been a good level of due diligence already done. And now it's the process of closing everything, mm-hmm. Clearing funds, et cetera. That takes some time. And Broadcom was, I think the reason they went after CA is because they got some regulatory restrictions on buying Qualcomm, I think. Hmm. They were trying to buy another chip manufacturer, and the regulator said, too big of a monopoly or something right. like that. So they ended up switching. the regulators could still get involved, right? So an acquisition like this
sure.
could invoke either EU or US or Asian regulators to mm-hmm. look at the deal and the structure of the deal to decide whether they're going to allow it to go through. Mm-hmm. Some deals have been killed by regulators. I don't know that that's the case here because it's a hardware company buying predominantly a software company.
Yeah, I see. It's so just software, right? I don't know if they have any subsidiaries that do any kind of hardware. To my knowledge, it's just software. But again, we only cover
it's all software.
And we only cover the usually the security side. Yeah, which is all software, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's interesting. We'll see how that plays out. Now, what's interesting in other acquisitions, Imperva is going to acquire the DevOps security leader. Of course, that's how they always put it in the headlines, Previty.
Yeah, I noticed the headline too. So I went to Previty's website and go, wait, they're a runtime application self-protection vendor. How does that make them the DevOps security leader? I'm not quite sure. But they do lead. They are the only leader in the runtime application security protection space. So I'll give them that one. DevOps security leader, that's a little bit of a stretch. But look, it's an interesting acquisition by Imperva for a couple things. I think we've got some numbers on Imperva's financials. They're slowing down their growth. They're a web app firewall. They were originally very hardware centric. They've needed to make some strategic moves. This move is, I think, a pretty good move for them.
It
stays in their core buyer persona, the application side. Mm-hmm. It's moving them into some newer technologies. In runtime application self-protection. I think it's a growing market. It'll continue to grow. So I think it's a wise move by Imperva because it stays in their core buyer persona, should be an easy upsell to their existing customers. It's a growing space as DevOps and containerization take off. I don't know that that's the end-all, be-all container security play, though. RAFs have some limitations in the containers, too. So you know, I'm not sure that it's all the way there, but it's a good first move. And it would be interesting to see if they make others in this space.
Yeah. See, I see it less from the market side and more from the consumer or the buyer side. And the trend that I notice is many organizations leaving their Imperva traditional WAFs for newer technology, such as RAS, such as the next generation WAFs that we, you know, Signal Sciences, for example, is a sponsor of the show. And other leaders in that, you know, newer leaders and innovative technology companies in that application protection space, I see them leaving Imperva. And when I saw the announcement that Imperva was financially taking a bit of a dip, it kind of made sense to what I was hearing from the buyers.
Yeah, I've seen them migrating. So you got the next gen guys like Signal Sciences and ThreadX and a few of those guys, yep. T-Cell, some others that are kind of this next generation WAF. But also to Amazon. You're losing web app firewalling to base Amazon services when you move up into Amazon Cloud, for example. Amazon has its own WAF, and it's literally a fraction of the cost of an Imperva device. So, you know, I've also seen the cloud providers putting some strain on the web app firewall guys as well, especially if you're cloud-based.
I've also noticed the same trend with Proofpoint. And again, Proofpoint could have fantastic technology. However, the trend that I'm noticing in the email phishing and spam gateway kind of arena or category, if you will, that Proofpoint is a lot of people are leaving Proofpoint and going to, again, some of these newer startups and newer companies that are providing the same level of service with some extra additional technology. I've seen some awesome technology in this space, Matt. You know, like installing the malware and hypervisors that run on the actual chipset and just doing some really cool stuff. And I think that's caused Proofpoint to lose some market share because people are like, I want the newer technology because it's going to be more efficient and more accurate and more and easier to deploy. I think is why they're losing market share, no?
Yeah, and you have the same thing going on here with like Mimecast and Office mm-hmm. 365, right? It's a perfect kind of 1-2 combination, O365 in the cloud, Mimecast in the cloud, who's also a public company, mm-hmm. A well-suited solution than going to something like Proofpoint, which is a little harder to install, a little older technology, et cetera. And here's what's interesting in the numbers. So if people want to understand how to read these silly things, right, I'll just pull out two interesting metrics out of the report. So revenue, total revenue, growing. Total revenue for second quarter was an increase of 40%, but bookings was only an increase of 35%. So if you understand how these numbers work, bookings are new revenue, new customers, and new logos. Revenue is what you can recognize after a deal. When bookings are less than revenue, that's a sign that revenue in the future will slow. So some interesting numbers there, right? Their GAAP numbers were okay. I think they still got a operating loss compared to last year. It seems to have gone up a little bit. Net income came down. So those are all kind of signs that things are slowing down, which aren't necessarily positive when you kind of dig into some of these numbers. So I agree with you. There, you know, well, it'll be interesting to see what does Proofpoint do something strategic to help it continue to grow, because it's hitting some headwinds here.
Now, is the announcement from Sophos kind of similar, or well, this stock has been upgraded? Does that mean they're doing well?
Yeah, this stock's been upgraded. I didn't dig into all the numbers here because I haven't looked at their last report, but there's positive signs for Sophos. So the investors that track them have upgraded them. It's interesting, you know. In the enterprise space, I don't see a lot of Sophos. You know, I run Sophos on my Macs at home, so I see them more as a consumer play. So I don't really track Sophos as closely as I would others in this space, just because to me they're more consumer play. But if they're upgraded, that usually is positive signs. So we'll have to see. But I didn't dig into their financials to know.
Yeah, I put that alongside Carbon Black, and I thought the Carbon Black announcement read that they were also doing very well, and I was curious to see how the market was playing out in terms of those adopting those traditional antivirus companies versus switching to that newer technology, which is a segment John Strand and I ran from a technical perspective, more of an enterprise perspective rather, on Enterprise Security Weekly. And I was curious to see if the market was reacting in the same way that same thing we've talked about with like Proofpoint and Imperva, right? Are the newer players taking market share?
Yeah. So the actual results aren't released until August 7th. And I couldn't get an indication here whether they're going to be positive or not. There was an open lawsuit against Carbon Black shortly after IPO. So I'm waiting to see what the impact of that is. So when the results come out August 7th, which is right before we... it's actually the day we're all flying to Black Hat.
Yes.
Maybe something we could cover later. But it will be interesting to see their results with this kind of lawsuit out there. And I think the interesting thing to see here will for Carbon Black will be for companies like CrowdStrike, Cylance, who are both considering IPOs, is, you know, if Carbon Black, which had also a pretty good IPO, can hit a couple quarters of good numbers, then I think you could see CrowdStrike and Cylance, even Tanium's been talking about this for a while, of getting ready to come out from an IPO perspective. It would be interesting. So I know those three companies are probably watching this announcement on the 7th as well.
And that's what we've speculated as well, just basically given the amount of funding that those three companies you mentioned, Cylance, CrowdStrike, and Tanium, the amount of funding they've taken, like their exit at this point is pretty much IPO. I mean, the chances of a larger company purchasing them at this point, like who's left that doesn't already have something on the endpoint that significantly overlaps with the functionality of what they have, right?
Yeah, I mean, both CrowdStrike and Tanium were mentioned in the Tenable undervalue article this morning as potential near-term IPOs. So yes, that's the expectation by the market right now, is both of those guys will go IPO soon.
There was one last story. So this one, I don't know how it ended up as Fortinet at Black Hat, but Fortinet, among other companies, have made a series of announcements to go into Google Cloud and their technology supporting Google Cloud. There was a Google conference recently, Matt, about their cloud. I thought you might know, as Layered Insight is more closer to that space than some of the companies that were mentioned, but like half a dozen companies all announced support for Google Cloud, I think in line with a Google event of some kind, right?
Yeah, so Google Next was last week. Mm-hmm. When I was in Singapore, Asif and a few of the other guys were tracking the Google Next announcements last week. And so, yeah, this is typical. You get a number of vendors that make announcements of supporting those technologies at their conferences, gets them some press. Mm-hmm. That's okay. The real interesting Google Next announcements were on some of the aspects of their edge computing play to compete with AWS's Greengrass, mm-hmm. which is going to be Android based. That was a pretty interesting announcement. I haven't gone through them all yet because I was 14 hours ahead mm-hmm. from a time zone perspective, and I haven't caught up on all my news yet. So I'm sure there are probably a couple other really good nuggets in that Google Next announcements last week. I just haven't gotten through them all yet.
Yeah, and I think to kind of round the show out, there is another story or two in there that we may not have covered. I'll leave that for your own reading. But when you're an executive today and you've got to make decisions, you know, what do I put in Azure? What do I put in Google Cloud? What do I put in AWS? Is it all three? Do I pick one? We could do an entire show, I think, on just that. But I think that's a decision that many of us are faced with today, you know, myself included. Where do you put your efforts, or do you, and how much do you structure your application so that you're independent of those providers?
Yeah, and it's interesting also because everybody kind of went to AWS first, right? Mm-hmm. And they had a big chunk of the cloud market, especially for startups. But it's interesting, as you're a startup or even established security company that's in the cloud, you get requests to be anything other than AWS sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that is because companies compete with AWS. So retailers are like, oh, I love your cloud solution, but I want it running in Azure or Google. I don't want it in AWS. Mm-hmm. And so as a security company, you have to think through, okay, what does that mean? How easily can I port what I built in AWS to these other environments? Because if you start to look at them now, a lot of functionality is there across all the three providers, I think, mm-hmm. pretty much. Some more platform stuff in Azure, some more advanced ML and analytics capabilities in Google, but all in all, they're the same. And the challenge that I think most early security companies make is they build to AWS, leveraging a lot of the AWS components because it speeds things up, mm-hmm. but it also limits how portable they are later. And so now you see architecture decisions kind of backtracking a little bit to say, do I really want to embed all these AWS components in it if I have to move it? Because it makes that move to an Azure or to a Google potentially a little more difficult. So those are some of the decisions that have to be made when you're thinking about your cloud strategy. If you're all in on AWS, it doesn't matter. But if you want a multi-cloud strategy, then you really have to think about portability from an architecture perspective, and what does that mean longer term? So those are just some of those decisions that people have to make. Mm.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Matt, for helping us cover Business Security Weekly this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening and watching. We'll see you next time.